Now a man in the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could not hide him any longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered, and the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water."
Alrighty. Good morning, friends. And happy Star Wars Day to those who celebrate. If you haven't heard of it, it's the 4th of May, or May the 4th, so may the 4th be with you. Or perhaps the power and blessing of God through his Holy Spirit, if that's more your jam. I come from a very Star Wars positive household, the original 6 movies at least. But I am also a pastor's kid who has been raised to turn everything into a sermon illustration. So you're welcome, and here we go. Jono and I recently started watching Star Wars again, coincidentally, but we are going to watch another one tonight in commemoration. We controversially, perhaps, began at episode 1, so the first prequel, that is, with The Phantom Menace, and we're going to watch them in chronological order instead of order of release, which I've never done before, but I am open to the experience. The character of Anakin, there he is there, is so fascinating to me. I'll try not to spoil too much, but the trajectory of his whole life, from child to death, is quite the journey. He entirely evolves as a person in many, many ways. But in The Phantom Menace, this first movie, we see where he comes from. Anakin, or Annie, as he's known as a kid, is an innocent, helpless, a little bit cheeky, pretty smart, but nobody kind of a kid, living on a slave planet that's ruled by a gang. He's into fixing stuff and pod racing, which is like the races, but with hovercrafts and a lot more cheating. And this kid doesn't know any other kind of life. And then suddenly, a ship with a couple of Jedi Knights arrives in town. Their ship has malfunctioned, and they've had to make an emergency landing to get it fixed. Here, these Jedi meet Annie, this young slave working for a parts dealer who's good at fixing things, but doesn't have much of a future there. The Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn, I don't know who comes up with the names of these people, but this is Liam Neeson's character, notices him. There was something about this kid. He couldn't shake the sense of extraordinariness that he sees. Long story short, Annie continues to amaze, and he ends up being brought to the Jedi Council. Qui-Gon believed that this kid could be the prophesied one they're waiting for, the one promised to bring balance to the galaxy. Their brief time on this planet was no coincidence. More things happen. It's a long movie. Anakin saves the day again. And eventually, despite a small battle with the Jedi Council, it's agreed that Anakin will be trained as a Jedi. I don't necessarily believe that Star Wars is a great blueprint for Christian theology. It's quite a mishmash of religious ideas. But this idea of a chosen one who comes from humble beginnings, who's prophesied to save the world, and who's deeply intimate with spiritual things before they even really realize it, and where people just can't let go that there's something special about them, that's familiar to us, isn't it? There are things about Moses in our passage this morning that are outside of his control. The time period in which he's born, where he comes from, his parents, and what happens to him as a young child. In the coming weeks, we're going to see the way he goes on to make some mistakes of his own and to encounter some of his own trouble and resistance, and also to be powerfully called by God himself. But in this very early stage of his life, it's so fascinating to see the ways that God has already set him aside as someone extraordinary who God has a purpose for. Moses is the only one specifically named in our passage this morning. He's the one in focus here. This is his origin story. So, let's walk through these short 10 verses. Now, a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. The name Levi might ring a bell, and it'll either be because you remember the original Levi, one of the sons of Jacob and the father of the tribe of Levi. Or it'll be because you've heard of the significance of this tribe of Levi and the way God sets aside this tribe to be the priestly tribe for the nation of Israel. Moses' brother Aaron, naturally also of the tribe of Levi, will crop up a bit later in Exodus, and he and his sons will be the first priests of the tabernacle. Priests were the ones who tended to the tabernacle, the place where God dwelt, and the sacrificial requirements as set out by God in those later wilderness days. They were the ones who were consecrated, set apart, and were the go-between between the people and the holy God, the mediators, the representatives. So when we read that Moses was the child of a Levite man and a Levite woman, even though the tribe of Levi hadn't been set aside as the priestly tribe until much later in Moses' life, we're meant to notice this detail about this child. He's a purebred of the line of Israelites that will become the mediators and representatives of the God, of the people to God in this line's earliest stages. Interesting. It's interesting to me anyway. In verse 2, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. So this couple gives birth to a child. And we must remember that at the time, there is an edict against baby boys surviving. Pharaoh is threatened by the Hebrew population. So to protect against an uprising, all the males were meant to be killed after they were born. Last week, our passage recounted a pair of midwives who feared God more than Pharaoh and cleverly found a way to let the boys live. Oh, the women are too strong for us. We never get there in time. Since that approach with the Hebrew midwives wasn't successful, it became an Egyptian responsibility. You could imagine some kind of search or patrol force popping into the Hebrew town and just checking that there aren't any baby boys lying around anywhere. This is the world that this child is born into. The odds of him surviving are low. But there's something about this child. We're not really sure what this phrase means, but whether it was a physical quality, a strong sense of extraordinariness, perhaps the Holy Spirit speaking wisdom to the mother, or whether it was the depth and force of a mother's love, or all of the above, she does everything she can to protect and hide her child from this death sentence for 3 months. There was something about him. He needed to be protected. And then in verse 3, we read that after 3 months, he's become too hard to hide. Maybe he's gotten too big, too noisy, too wriggly to keep hidden at home. So Moses' mother both obeys and disobeys Pharaoh. She places him in the Nile as per instructions, but protected and in secret, in a location where he'd be concealed yet kept alive. And here we have an image that might remind us of a key section of the book of Genesis, someone in a tar-coated, so waterproofed, vessel, floating on the waters that were otherwise deadly for those not on board. Someone otherwise destined for death, but chosen. There's this parallel to Noah and the ark in Genesis. And the word for basket here is the same exact word used for Noah's ark. And those are the only two times you see those words in the Old Testament. So there's a specific choice of language here, linking and comparing the two stories. The purpose of this reference, just like Noah, God protects the one he chooses to bring deliverance. God protects his deliverer. Moses' sister is standing, watching. We don't know whether the point was that Moses would be found, or whether it was a temporary hiding spot during the day, or whether there wasn't really a plan at all. But the sister is keeping an eye out. And then it seems like it all goes to custard. Pharaoh's daughter spots him in the reeds. The princess of the very regime calling for his death is now the holder of his fate. But here we see God's protection and divine power again. Even knowing he's a Hebrew baby, she has compassion on this child. Moses' sister, the little entrepreneur, boldly asks whether a Hebrew wet nurse would be helpful. The princess agrees, and so naturally, Moses' sister goes and fetches her own mother. And it's a pretty great arrangement for everyone. Moses' mother is paid by the Egyptian emperor's daughter to nurse her own son. But even more significant, she's able to do it in broad daylight. No more hiding. She's on commission to make sure her son is healthy and strong, on instruction from the people who were killing all Hebrew baby boys. The irony here is intense and amazing. God protects his deliverer. Moses gets older and is adopted as part of Pharaoh's household. And the Egyptian name he's given, Moses, reflects his origin story. He was drawn out of the water. This is all we know of Moses' early days from Exodus, but there's a bit more that we can glean from other parts of the Bible. In Acts chapter 7, we read about Stephen, one of the early Christians who comes up against some resistance from the religious leaders in the ministry that he's doing, and I believe he becomes the first Christian martyr. He preaches to these religious leaders about how they're acting as ignorant and stubborn as the Hebrews were when Moses was leading them in the wilderness. And within this quite scathing sermon, we see some of the Jewish tradition and wisdom about Moses that was passed down the generations, despite the fact it's not specifically in the Exodus account itself. So Acts 7, 20 to 22. At that time, Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months, he was cared for by his family. When he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him and brought him up as her own son. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. So here we see something I find interesting. Moses was given the education and upbringing of an Egyptian prince. He was taught the history, culture, wisdom, and probably theology of Egypt. Moses was raised in Pharaoh's house, whatever that looked like, and raised in Egyptian thinking. And yet, if we flip back to Exodus 2, verse 11, one verse after our passage today, we read, "One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian fighting a Hebrew, one of his own people." The following events, I won't spoil it for next week, but the following events and the way this is written suggests he still considers the Hebrew people his own people. So even though most of Moses' life was spent being raised as an Egyptian, and a royal one at that, it appears he still identified himself with the Hebrews. He's aware of his adopted status and where he's come from. We don't know how long Moses spends being nursed by his own mother amongst his own family, but it seems to me formational enough that he doesn't completely lose his Hebrew identity in the midst of this royal adoption. Here's why I think this is important. Moses, of the priestly line, was not only protected by God in a time where he was not meant to survive. He was spared from death by the family of the one who had ordered his death, and even lived in the house and under the nose of this Pharaoh, a walking exception to the rule, a walking loophole, walking evidence of the original threat. And yet, even in Pharaoh's house, under his nose, Moses wasn't completely absorbed into the Egyptian regime. He retained some, even if it was a small part of his Hebrew identity, likely because of this time he was nursed and raised at home with his faith-filled Hebrew parents. And the more I think about it, I can't see any other explanation other than that God's hand was very powerfully and specifically and delicately at work. Moses was a uniquely positioned and connected kid, and given qualities and circumstances that God would go on to use to free his people. All before Moses was old enough to even understand his situation. This all precedes his skills, his abilities, his decisions. He has nothing to do with it. The truth of the matter is that God started writing this story a long, long time ago. From the floods all the way back to Noah, to the promises God made to Abraham that Ben spoke about last week, way before they were even a people, to the details of Moses' heritage, to the timing of his discovery in the Nile, to his exposure to both worlds and his perfect protection throughout it all. God was totally in and amongst it, totally in control, using all of the ugly stuff. We see the way God protects his chosen deliverer, the one he purposes to lead the people out of oppression and into the promise. Nothing can threaten God's promises, and no protection is stronger than his. So we've compared, just on a very surface level, Anakin to Moses, very surface level. We've seen parallels between Noah and Moses, where God's chosen one boards a vessel and then later wipes out and drowns all the wickedness for the saving of God's people. We're going to see one last example of this trope, this pattern, in the New Testament. So turn with me to Matthew chapter 2. Jesus has been born, and the Magi have just come and delivered their gifts. And if we remember, Herod, the reigning king at the time, has been trying to extract information about this seemingly very important baby that these wise spiritual men have perceived has been born, and who seems to be shaping up to have kingly significance. He's trying to arrange an audience with this baby. That's the context. So we'll read from Matthew chapter 2, verse 13. When they had gone, an angel, they meaning the Magi, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Okay, there is so much we could talk about here. Joseph is told to take his young family to Egypt to hide his young son, Jesus, from an angry king who was threatened by him. And this king called for a mass slaughter of all boys in Jesus' specific age range because he was threatened. But they escaped and hid in time. Jesus was a refugee. God protects his deliverer. Can we see the similarities here? Wild. What's the significance of Egypt as a hiding place? Well, first, it's poetic, isn't it? But it's also actually a reference from the prophet Hosea, which reads, we're jumping all over the place today, Hosea, which reads, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." So the son here is the people of Israel. Hosea is speaking about how Israel's turned from God, as they did over and over and over again, but how God longed for his people Israel like a parent. He rescued them and called them out of Egypt and made them his people. Spoiler alert. Hosea's referencing the Exodus here and how that is the ultimate proof at that time of God's love for them, that he delivered them out of the oppression in Egypt and made them his own. We're going to dive into that whole process in the next few weeks. But back to Jesus, hiding away in Egypt from mass infanticide. After Herod dies, Joseph takes Jesus and Mary to Galilee. And in doing so, Jesus fulfills this image of God calling his son, or his chosen one, now Jesus, out of Egypt, just like he called his chosen people, the original son in this passage, out of Egypt. God has been writing this story for such a long time. Look at his power. Look at his specific and delicate details. This very small detail from Hosea in a large piece of prophecy coming to rest and finding its home fully and perfectly in Jesus. And this is not an active decision of Jesus's. He doesn't look for an opportunity to fulfill this verse or do anything to help it happen. Jesus is two at this time. Just like Moses, before he even knows the situation, before he's even aware of it, God is perfectly positioning Jesus to be the deliverer that his people have been anticipating and waiting for generations. God protects his deliverer, and God has been writing this story for a very long time, and God is totally in and amongst it, in the details and using all the ugly stuff. If you're still exploring this Jesus guy, maybe you're new to faith or you've been called back after a long time or you're still just thinking about it, I've had you on my heart as I was preparing this week, and I just felt to encourage you. These stories aren't just myths, and that's why they all conveniently slot into each other and share imagery and locations and details. These things really happened, and they happened hundreds or thousands of years apart from each other. Archaeology and historical records beyond the Bible will verify this very wonderful story that God has been writing for such a long time. This God of power and of a delicate and specific hand, it's all true. We can see traces of this big story on our planet and on our world, and that's beyond crazy. And it creates some quite important implications. I just wanted to bless you in that journey and know that we are here to walk with you and talk further. Ben spoke to us last week about some key reasons reading the Old Testament is still super important and relevant to us in this place and in this time. He spoke about how the Old Testament teaches us about God's character, because that same God of the Old Testament is the God we know and obey today. We also gather insights about God's promises to his people, which helps give us a fuller background picture of all that Jesus is and all that he achieved. And we can also learn some wisdom about life with God that is relevant in our journey with him today. In Moses' early years, we see the faithfulness of God, that God made promises to raise up a deliverer to free his people, and how he wove together the most wonderful story to fulfill them. Everything happened just as he said it would. God is faithful and keeps his promises. We see God the protector in the lives of Noah, Moses, Jesus. In the face of certain death and opposition, God protects his deliverer, because of course he can. Of course he will. We also see that God cares about the details, and as Ben said last week, timing matters to God. So many things about Moses' circumstances prepared him and positioned him to be the deliverer that Israel needed, and even more so with Jesus. God's specific and delicate hand made it so. God has been writing this story for a very long time. There is a fantastic promise from Jesus that we're still waiting to be fulfilled in its fullness, where God is still writing the story. Jesus is returning to make all things new and to finish the work of restoring and reconciling all things to him that's already begun. One day there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things will pass away. This same promise-keeping God of power, might, and a delicate hand is the same God who promises to make all things new, free from pain and death. We can trust this promise. We can trust this promise-keeping God. We can trust our God knows the details of our life and treats us with a delicate hand. There will be many of us here who have seen the faithfulness of God in our own life, in our own stories. But if you're not sure that you have, look here. Look to this story. Look to this God of power and a delicate hand. He's the same. God protected his chosen deliverers. God is a God who keeps his promises and has been writing the story we're now a part of for a very long time. Let's let this truth settle in our hearts this morning, and let it lead you to wonder and awe, and let it lead you to worship and pray.